that, or will preserve or produce an image that has that bilateral symmetry associated with it. Three mappings which can do that would be if you always map normal to the body surface, if you always map normal to the cloth surface, or if you map normal or parallel to the axis of symmetry. Okay. So, but and what's interesting is that when you do this, the location of this point will map to quite different areas on the cloth. And it seems to me that what we ought to see here is we ought to be able to detect this, because it does appear that in regions where you have large deviations in slope of the cloth and body, we ought to be able to see that. But over most of the image, the body surface and cloth surfaces are fairly flat, and you probably could not detect it. So I'd like to just show you just a few things on this, then that'll be it. Next slide. Okay, we constructed to do this, we had to get a cloth drape of a cloth over a body surface. Eric Jumper and I made a cloth model of the shroud. Next slide. And with the help of team member Robert Buckland, we configured bodies into the cloth. Next slide. The volunteer subjects at the Biostereometrics Laboratory in Texas. Next slide. We covered them with a cloth, with our cloth model. Next slide. We made sure that the image that we had on the cloth was over the corresponding body parts. Blood images had to make contact, and then we have the cloth drape. Next slide. The image was then photographed biostereometrically, and when you do that, next slide, first of all with the cloth in place and then with the cloth removed, next slide. Next slide. These are live bodies too, by the way. When you do this, look at the stereometric pictures, you have then distance information, surface information of the body surfaces. Next slide. And this was the results, that these are five individuals, five subjects, and this is the way their profiles at the nose looked like, and these were the way the cloth draped over it. I wanted to show this to you to get a feeling for the kinds of deviations in cloth drape and body and nose surfaces that we're dealing with. Next slide. Now, if we take a look at the face profile, this is an actual model. In fact, this is the largest nose that we had in our experiments. I'll show you the shorter, the smallest nose in just a minute. But I have a microdensitometer trace of the shroud image above it to the exact scale as we have here. Now there's your nose, there's your cheek, if that's the bruised cheek, here's the other cheek, and here's your hair. This is right at the level of the nose. Now if I project down where the location of the nose ends relative to the cheeks, as we would see on the image, bring it down to here, and then locate it at a point where this distance along the curvature of the cloth is equal to the distance horizontally, then we can position where this point would lie onto the cloth, and then simply compare it to where it lies in our experiment. And these then produce the mapping function for that nose under this cloth relative to this image, to the shroud image. Next slide shows the same thing except with the small nose. So you kind of have the same thing here. What I see in this is that I don't see any way that image on the shroud could be the result of if we assume a cloth draping over a body, that it would be the result of a normal mapping to a body surface. I don't see how it could be a normal mapping to the cloth surface. What it looks like is that it's essentially trying to be parallel to this axis of symmetry here. So I think if we're going to say there's a body under a cloth, to my thinking, we would just about have to say that that the projection looks something like this. Okay, next slide. We look at the knees. These are from the biostereometrics data as well. Here's your microdensitometer trace. Actually, it's an interpolated curve from data from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. The dots were around the points here. Again, you have your knees, and the images of the knees here appear to be essentially over the over the knees that you see. I don't consider this as convincing as the previous slide, because knees can be separated apart. People can have different kinds of knees. You ought to see my knees, for example. Next slide. But I think one interesting thing is about the hands, another point of cloth contact. Let's go to the next slide. Something that has puzzled me for a long time is this right here. Right here, where this top hand goes over the bottom hand. There's a blanking of the image at this point. There's also a blanking of the image in this area. It runs up the sides of the forearms too. Next slide, where we can see it a little bit differently. This is a computer picture that Don Devan made for me, one of our very first. But it turns out this, and because of the shading, this is a dark area. You have this blanking area out here and going up in this area. But the main point is right here. That's what I want to talk about. Next slide. Again, there's your blanking. This is Don Lin's, second Don, or first Don, I guess. And again, we still have that blanking effect. Next slide. This is a biostereometrics curve of the cloth over the body. And the top of the hand, where that blanking would occur, is right in this area. Now, I don't know of any way to in my own thinking, to reasonably explain how you get that blanking effect on that bottom hand, other than if the cloth was sort of against the, or having a fair amount of slope relative to this, to the hand, such that an image was not produced. And this would be consistent with the notion that if this image was parallel to this axis of bilateral symmetry, or in the prone position, if you assume a prone position, vertical. If that's the way the mapping occurs, then we would not have image formed in that area. Next slide. And it's possible that maybe that's the reason why we don't see any images along the side of the body over the top of the head, with the exception of the dorsal image of the foot. But when you put a person in the cloth, those feet are almost horizontal, because they just naturally lay in that direction. Next slide. Okay, you might ask, what does an image look like that is a projected parallel to the axis of symmetry? Well, we have biostereometrics data. I constructed a contour cavity of the cloth drape. Could put a little cloth model in here and then project the image, next slide, onto that cavity. And then I can draw the image, next slide, on the contours. This is the one we started with. It's a drawing of the same one you saw before. I project it onto the cloth, unfold the cloth, and this is the way a distorted image would look if you're dealing with the parallel projection mapping. It looks fairly distorted, especially down here relative to the shroud, but we have to be careful because we see the image by distance from the cloth to the body, and it fades out, so we don't know exactly where these are absolute boundaries, and where the discernible boundary would be would probably very likely be within these boundaries here. Bill Urkelein will talk about cloth drape distortions a little bit later. Next slide. So my conclusions are that the image is what I think is the image is not the result of a mapping normal to the body surface if we assume that there's a cloth draping over the body. And I want to make that clear that it is based upon that assumption. The image is not the result of a mapping normal to the cloth surface, but it does seem to be if we assume that the image was created with a body-shaped line, as it would be suggested in the shroud, horizontal by a kind of vertical mapping. Okay, and on the final slide, the final two slides, let me try to put all this together, the last three talks that I gave, as to what I think would be kind of a mnemonic, I guess you might say, sort of a graphical scheme for trying to illustrate how one might go about creating an image on the shroud. I'm not saying that this is the image formation mechanism, and I'll tell you why in just a minute, but if one were to take a body surface, and if you were to take a series of little flux lines, and let's map them vertically, but attenuate them with distance away from the body surface, and then count the number of flux lines that penetrate the cloth surface, then you can create a little histogram of intensity. And if we take the limit as the number of flux lines goes to infinity and the amount of intensity shading that each flux line gives you goes to zero, you can create a continuous distribution, which I sort of sketched in would look probably something like this. I'm not saying this is the image formation mechanism. I'm just offering it as a graphical device for tying together the things that I think I see on the image on the shroud. That's no different than in the next slide, something that happened with Ptolemy, who's a Greek who was trying to model how planets went around the Earth. He could see planets moving around in the skies, and the planet would move around, and he described these by epicycles moving around the Earth. This gave a very good understanding as to how planets moved, but with the work of Newton and then later Einstein in this century, this model was not the basic physics of what was going on, but it did give you anyone an insight as to what's happening. I believe I hear John frantically knocking on the microphone, so that will conclude my presentation. Thank you.
It occurs to me that some of you normal people might from time to time have questions of us abnormal people as to what all of this means, or what it might mean, or how we think about it. And if I had some house lights, it might help me think. Because I'm trying to find out whether or not there's any provision in here for a question period sooner or later so that you can ask the questions which I'm sure must be developing. Some of the questions I think will come out of, some of the answers may come out of some of the later presentations, but I don't really see, there's a summary, but I don't see a question period, so maybe the powers that be might consider at some period in time to permit the audience to ask questions of the abnormal people as to what we think some of these things mean. In the meantime, this ends our morning session, by golly, at noon, and session number two begins at 1:30 this afternoon, same place, and more information in different areas. Thank you all.
Back to the audience. The image of geometric distortions induced by cloth thread. They're both at the Air Force Academy. Bill, are you the first one on?
I'm the boss, Mr. Earl.
All right. Fall down and Bill Earl. Thank you. It's Bob. First slide, please. We have the lights, please.
There's something there. All right. The topic of this talk is the examination of the shroud image for possible geometric distortions due to cloth drape. Next slide, please. You might remember this slide from the last speaker. In his talk, Dr. Jackson indicated from this work that he did, that you might expect distortion of the image due to the fact that the cloth draped over the body, when you flatten it out, would give you a somewhat different perspective on the body image than we have if you just took, say, a photograph of the body lying flat. We set out to establish this or to check this out, and essentially that's what we intended to do, was to take a group or a sample of individuals, take them, lie them down, mold them to the body position indicated on the shroud, and then make measurements using a photographic, just taking a picture of them from above so that we eliminate as much of the distortion as possible, and then compare that data to the data on the shroud. Now, normally speaking, we might go to anthropometric tables, but anthropometric tables normally are not based on an individual in a position somewhat as that on the slide. So we had to select our own population and to mold them to that image. So if we go to the next slide, please. We had a unique opportunity to do this at the Academy. We had a summer workshop where we presented information on the shroud for some visiting high school students. And so to gather some data for them to work with, we asked for cadet volunteers. We selected cadets who were 175 centimeters tall, plus or minus 5 centimeters. And we subjected them essentially to a molding process where we lay them on a model or a replica of the shroud and positioned them so that they were as much as possible in the position of the image that we see from the shroud as we could get. Some critical points were the knee positions and the head position, the overall shoulder tilt, hand positions. Next slide, please. We also used the top part of the shroud to try to mold, make sure contact points were as much in alignment as possible. Next slide. Here you can see Bill Ertline, again, making sure the arms fit the position, making sure the hands cross as close as possible, trying to reproduce the image on the shroud as closely as possible with the positioning of the cadets. Next slide. Now we did this on a diving platform. There were two reasons. One is it gave us ready access to cadets who were clad as minimally as possible for this kind of presentation. The other thing was it also gave us a way of positioning the cadets in a horizontal position and then getting a vertical height above them so that we could shoot down and get essentially a planar photograph of their position. Next slide, please. And this is pretty much what a typical sample looks like. You'll notice two measuring bars. There is a meter stick running up the length of the cadet, and across the bottom is a 70 centimeter stick, which we could also use as a reference. This also showed us whether we were getting distortions horizontally versus vertically. And if you notice, they're also on a square tile background, which again gives us some indication if we start to get aberrations because of the optics of the camera or whatever. Each cadet is numbered. You see his number down in the corner so that we can refer to that later. We also recorded their weight, height, and I think those were the only two parameters that we kept track of. Next slide, please. We'll just flip through a few slides here and just show you some of the samples that we have. You can see that they vary quite a bit in height and weight and overall body look or body build, but their basic contours, and they're basically formed to the contour of the shroud as close as possible. Could you just flip through the next couple of slides, please? Okay, fine, thank you. Now, after we collected the data, the first thing we did is we reviewed the slides that we got with the people. We had gathered some people to help us do the measuring. Of course, we had to take measurements from the slide data. And the first thing we did is we had to choose which slides we wanted to use in the sense that some of the positions, some of the people had slipped their positions during the photography session. For instance, we lined them up, and while the photographer was, we were removing the shroud and what have you, or the cover, their hands had slipped. Either their hands had slipped down the wrist, or their hand had slipped in the body, head tilt changed. One critical thing was the position of the nose. The person had to be looking essentially vertically upward if measurements from, say, nose to knee were going to be meaningful. If the person is looking too high or too low, that's going to change the position of the tip of the nose, which was a key measuring point. So we took essentially a ballot of those people who were going to do the measurements, comparing directly the individual sample with the front image of the shroud. And this gave us a pretty good chance to rule out people who had obviously changed their position during the photographic session. We ended up with about 50 samples, which we then measured, which if you please flip the slides. Next three or four slides are just showing some of the measuring. And then we did the data analysis on those 50 samples. We took various sample points. Okay, please hold there. And those were based on looking for positions, looking for measuring spots where we either expected maximum distortion based on that initial slide, or positions where we expected minimum distortion so that we could then compare the averages that we got to some anthropometric data that Bill's going to talk about now.
what does all this mean? And I guess I want to answer that question first, and it's basically this. If the image on the shroud was caused by a body shape, form, however you want to say it, then you have to be able to detect some type of distortion if you have the entire image on the shroud. It's just physically impossible not to have that. If I can make a little analogy here, next time you come out of the shower, if you have a dark towel, put some talcum on your body and just kind of drape the towel around it and take a look at the result you see on the towel, and you'll notice that you're wider in certain areas. And this is kind of what the second slide you saw showed, and that's what John Jackson showed earlier, that there is regions you would expect to find distortion. And I'll talk about those in a minute. But basically, the data we have, we wanted to compare it to something. Well, all we had was our cadet sample, so we had to do a little research there, and we found that in the mid-60s, the Air Force did a large survey and determined some anthropometric data to determine what an average person measured. Okay, they kind of gave you the range of his certain parts of his body. It's for cockpit design, human factors engineering. And the next two slides kind of show some of that. Just zip through those, and I'd like to get right into the data. You can get the measurements across the body and width of the head and hands, fingers, lengths, things like that. Okay, go to the next slide. Now this is what we got. These are our results. And basically, in the first column is the Air Force Systems Command, the anthropometric data, then our cadet average, and then what we measured on the shroud itself. We had a scaling factor to make sure we had everything scaled to real life. And basically, the width of the hand, again, the width of the hand, and if a cloth draped over a body at the width of the hand, you would expect minimum distortion. The systems command average is 8.92 centimeters. And you can see the cadet average here is a little larger than that, but within a standard deviation. And the width of the hand, this is the top hand on the shroud across the knuckles, measures about 8.3 centimeters. So you see that this is a little smaller than this measurement, but still everything is within about a standard deviation. Nothing significant there. Now, I'll come back to this slide. I want to go forward a little bit to give you an idea of what we've done here. Go to the next slide, please. Again, we're measuring across here. Go to the next slide. Again, across here on the hand. Go to the next slide. And again, to use that, what we're measuring here is the width across the hand, the knuckles, and you can see by the area of this slide here, without the grid system on, you can see that in this region, throughout the body, there is minimal distortion. You would not expect to find distortion there. And also, if you just do some rough calculations on that, you find that going from top to bottom of the image, you find that from the real person, it's about a 3% distortion. Going horizontally, though, you get significantly more. You get about 9% distortion. So what we're saying is 3% in this region in here, along this central vertical axis, there is minimal distortion, or distortion is so small that you can't detect it from any noise you're going to pick up in your experiment. However, when you go this way, you can start picking up some distortion. There's about a 9% variation in the change here. Now, if you can quickly go back to the data slide, about three slides. Again, some other measurements we had, as you can see, this was kind of the width of the face as you look on it. And on the shroud, this was a little difficult to measure, because if you remember the shroud slides, the facial feature kind of disappears as you get close to the hair. But basically, you can see the systems command measurement, the cadet average falls reasonably close, and then the shroud's a little bit wider. Again, you should expect something here. And again, this is an approximation. But like some other regions we measured here, middle of the eye, right across the nose, down to the crotch, on the systems commands here, the cadet average is here, and the shroud here. top of the head to the knee. Very, very a little change here. Now, here's some of the significant ones. The hip breadth, the width of the hips, the systems command measurement, the cadet average, and then the shroud measurement. You notice you get about 3 standard deviations outside the average here. And also the right forearm, now we estimated again the position of the elbow up to the fingertip of the extended hand. You find that here's the Air Force Systems Command measurement, the anthropometric data, our cadet average within the standard deviation, and then the shroud measures significantly longer. And if you real quick slip back up to that slide of the black on white, the white on black, about right there. On this slide, what it's showing you is a measurement from about here, we estimated that on the shroud, down to where the tip of the fingers would be. All right, now here you'll notice the person posing here, the fingers did not quite get over into this region. You can't really pick up the distortion that well. However, if you look on the shroud, you can see again. Now you can't determine it exactly, but you can kind of see the fingers look a little bit longer in that area. And you would expect that. That's what this slide shows. As you get into this region, you start picking up distortion. And just flip it back to the data, and then I'll get to the conclusion here. Just go back again. I'd like to show you the comparison of one other item. And we have this for about 27 different points. I'm just giving you a recap, and they all are consistent. Where we expect distortion, we are picking it up. We are picking a larger measurement here. Where we would expect minimal distortion, that is also conforming. Now, the middle finger on the average, the anthropometric data, 9.8, focus that a little bit, the cadet about 9.86 again. And what appears to be the length of the finger on the shroud, the middle finger of the extended hand appears to be about 12 centimeters. And again, like I mentioned, I showed you on that other slide that that is in an area where you would expect distortion. So what did we conclude from all this? If you go to the last slide, please. Save a little bit of time right there. Here's what Bob and I concluded from this. Basically that because of what we feel is detectable distortion on the cloth through the measurements, that the image was formed by a cloth draped over a body. That's what Bob and I kind of concluded on that. Now, I'm not saying that's the conclusion that STIRP is putting out. That still has to be argued with and things like that. But that's kind of what we're saying with the numbers we've got. And the other one is, if you want to do a little approximation there, if you have a 3% distortion in the length, you can estimate a different size, because I feel there is some distortion there. There could be. It seems to be detectable, and we feel a better approximation of the height is about 5'8". And then if you kind of interpolate from there, given those measurements that we're getting on the shroud where we'd expect little distortion, you can use the anthropometric data and you can get about an average weight, and you get about 155 pounds if you do that. So we feel that that's a better approximation of the size of the man on the shroud. That's it.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Bill. Our next two talks are going to be on the pathology and the forensic pathology on the shroud image. They're going to be given by Dr. Joe Gambisha, who's at the St. Agnes Medical Center in Philadelphia, an internist and professor of medicine in Hahnemann, by Dr. Robert Buckland, who's in the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner's Office and a professor of pathology at the University of Southern California. Bob, I believe you're going first.
Thank you very much, Alan. Time is very precious, and we have an awful lot of material to present in a very, very short time. Joe and I have divided this up, and I'm going to give you the basic pathological aspects, and Joe is going to concentrate more on areas that he's had personal experience and some investigative work with. One of the requirements of a forensic pathologist is that he take a totally objective approach to situations. Very often we're presented with a body injured, but no details of what happened. It's up to us to decide as much as we can about that particular individual. We have to decide first, is it a human? Is it a male? Is a rigor mortis present? How long has he been dead? What does this particular wound mean? What might have caused it? And we have to do this within the realm of medical probability. We've got to be more likely correct than incorrect. Sometimes that just means 51% right, and that's not a very good right average. But by the same token, that is what the requirement is. You've heard quite a bit of medical stuff already, and let me see if I can concentrate and bring some of this into focus. The first slide, please. And the lights. This is the front view of the body. Maybe the lights on. As you look at the body as a pathologist, you're first convinced that, I'm convinced, it's a human body. The measurements fit pretty much into the proportions that you would expect of a body, and two of the speakers before me have indicated that this is true. Particularly emphasizing the injuries. Each wound makes its own particular kind.